Hello and welcome to Cage Club. Two fans, nearly 100 movies, one cage. This is episode 104, Color Out of Space, from either 2019 or 2020. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And with us today, kind of the reason, not the entire reason it was delayed, we had someone, one of our past guests, really wanted to watch this movie with us, and he is becoming a doctor, but we're like, you know what, your life has been miserable for months, let's bring you on here, self-admittedly miserable, let's bring you on here, talk about this movie that you've been looking forward to for, oh, we're doing the Now and Again can crack on air, cool. So let's bring you on here to talk about the movie that you want to talk about. So it came out on Blu-ray, I think, like 2 weeks ago. It was out in theaters in January, but yeah. Not in New Jersey.
Yeah, it actually was.
One screening.
For one night only.
One night only, at the one AMC. Wednesday at the AMC in Garden State Plaza. With us today to talk about Color Out of Space, we have Chris Podcast. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. You have not been... What was the last one you were on? You were on our Trespass rewatch.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Trespass.
You were on Pay the Ghost with us.
I was. Oh, I was on the Superman documentary.
Oh, yeah. The rewatch of that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was all at your old apartment.
It was. Yeah.
I haven't been on a podcast in a while. I hope I don't screw this up.
You've screwed up every other one that you've ever done, so...
What would be the difference?
Yeah, what's the difference there? So this movie, in case you have not seen it yet, it's hard to describe this movie, but Nicolas Cage plays a father of three in a family of five who lives on his father's farm.
Yes.
They have alpacas.
They raise alpacas.
They also have crops and such, and one night, a rock falls from outer space, this like magenta rock falls from outer space, crashes outside, things go wrong. And basically, through the course of the movie, we learn that the rock has tainted the water supply, which just coincidentally, there's a hydrologist in the area there to test the water sample, the water table, for this new mayor who's running for office or running for re-election. As the rock's effects bleed into the water, there's all these like things, like there's like these creatures that like nobody sees until I guess it's too late. There's like these giant fruits and vegetables that grow.
Crazy mutations.
Nicolas Cage everybody kind of slowly loses their mind. Nicolas Cage smells something that he can't identify, kind of becomes mad. The mom goes through like temporary insanity, cuts off a couple of her fingertips. The son just kind of loses all sense of time and space. He just seems to like be like losing time. The daughter like really doubles down on her Wiccan rituals. And the other son just kind of stares at the well to talk to his friend in the well. As the movie goes on, shit gets Lovecraftian, because this is based on a H.P. Lovecraft short story, and so at one point the youngest son and the mom get fused together by lightning,
yep.
And they become this like horrifying monster of a thing. All the alpacas and all the other animals in the area get fused together to become this like coalesced, diseased, whatever.
Another thing.
The hydrologist, who suddenly becomes like the protagonist of the movie in the last like half hour, shows up with the police. Everybody dies, basically, in one way or another.
And welcome to Lovecraft country, pretty much, man. That's how it goes.
And then
go
in
mad
the
or die.
End, he has like a closing monologue where he's just like, you know, aliens could still be out there, but that's the color out of space, man. And that's the movie. Like, yeah. That's not a fair at all explanation of what it is, but that's also kind of exactly what it is.
Well, get it. You have to expand it more than just, you know, crazy rock crashes from space and makes everything
and
go insane.
Go weird. Yeah.
You have to flesh that out just a little.
I have a thing to say.
Okay.
And this hurts my heart.
Uh-oh.
I think this movie would be a lot better without Nicolas Cage in it.
Weird.
I've heard that from a lot of people.
I think I like everything about this, and I think... I don't know if this is turning the tide on me, but I think he is by far the worst part of this movie.
Really?
I think I like this movie in spite of him.
Hmm.
I think... When we started this podcast, Mike, we set out to see...
I'm sorry, but I'm having... I know.
I know.
My brain is, like,
reforming
parts of my mind.
I saw your Letterboxd score, because I was wondering if you were going to align with me or if you were going to like it in spite of him or because of him, and I saw that you gave it a really high score.
Yeah, for a really combination of a lot of different things.
When you and I started this podcast, we wanted to prove, or see if we could prove, that Nicolas Cage was a good actor and not just a series of memes.
Right.
And I feel like through the time where we caught up with Pay the Ghost, with our guest Chris Podcasts, I think with a few exceptions, he had pretty consistently shown a wider range than ever. He was never really overacting unless it was like on purpose, like in weird things where he's just like, hey, I'm gonna do my own version of the movie in Vampire's Kiss or whatever, right? Like there were reasons he went thing. And I feel like over the last few years, basically as we've done the show since we caught up, he has leaned more and more into those trailer moments and the overacting and the voices, and I don't know why he does everything. Like, he just feels like he's being Nicolas Cage in this movie.
And you don't like the vampire's kiss?
No, I don't like it at all. And we are rocketing toward a time where it's like the unbearable weight of talent or whatever
the
movie's
called.
He's
going to play himself.
And I am just terrified. And I hope...
It's like something's in the well and in your backyard, and it's Nick Cage's future.
And I should love this movie because it's beautiful, and it's gross, and it's weird, and it's like gorgeous to look at, and like it's crazy, and yet a couple times that he like does the voice, I'm laughing, and I'm like, wait, no, I'm not. They want me to laugh, but like, I don't actually enjoy this.
Interesting.
And I was so turned off by his performance in this movie.
I can't believe what I'm hearing.
That I was just like, oh, this is. I feel dirty saying this and writing, but like, I don't like him at all in this movie.
Whoa, I've got to process that. Just like immediate sort of like response to that, like. When this movie started, I was like, I can't remember the last time I've seen him so tame and sort of reined in. And I was like, this is great. He can show he's being so simple here and everything. And I was like, I know shit's going to hit the fan at one point, and I'm glad he's here to portray that. And I thought that this was more of a film that, like, we could have a serious horror movie and actually play to some of his strengths. I could see it without him, but I'm glad he's here, because if I want someone to portray the infinite madness of horror and stuff, like, I get it from him by the end of the movie and stuff. So, like, just sort of, you know, immediate, I just had to get back.
Like,
I enjoy him in this a lot, and I'm gonna see where you're coming from by the end of this, but, like, yeah, I was just not expecting to hear that at all.
I mean, it's, what you're saying is fairly universal from what I've been seeing, is that a lot of people don't like Nick Cage in this movie, and I'm coming at this from the perspective of someone who, like, absolutely loves the works of H.P. Lovecraft. I'm a huge fan. It's part of why I wanted to be on this episode. I think the moment this was announced, I was like, shotgun.
Yeah.
I was excited to see someone portray that, like you said, the madness and the sanity loss that comes from being a Lovecraft protagonist. And Lovecraft, for what he is now, is kind of this revered author, was, you know, kind of pulpy. And I thought Cage would be perfect for that. And I think the fact that he was restrained for so much of it means, I think this was all really a decision that he made in how to portray that madness. And it's very cagey. It does take you a little bit out of the movie. It reminds you you're watching Nicolas Cage and not a character. Like, he's like a 9 out of 10 on the Cage scale, I would say, probably at times in this movie. But I liked it. I thought it worked. But yeah, it is Nick Cage. You know that it's Nick Cage.
So I did not read the online reception before this. Like, I didn't know.
I didn't read anything. Or
I read some. I read the people that I follow on Letterboxd, their reviews of this after. And one of the people who saw the Fantastic Fest that I follow said that he doesn't understand that criticism, because if Nicolas Cage was not in this, Richard Stanley, who did direct but then got cut out of Island of Dr. Moreau, there's the whole Lost Soul or whatever
documentary
about it. This is his first movie in 20 years. Like, this guy that I was following said, if Cage was not in this, whoever they cast, the direction would probably be like, act like Nicolas Cage. And I feel like, while that's valid, that also sucks. Because I know that Nicolas Cage has more nuance than this. And it feels like there's one thing that said that Richard Stanley said that his favorite Nicolas Cage movie is Vampire's Kiss. And he wanted him to play basically that character in this.
Oh, okay.
And it just irks me that this doesn't feel new or original. It just feels like he's doing the voice, like when he pops into a voice in like a lesser movie. And I think part of my problem here is that this was supposed to be, to me, kind of an elevated fare. Like, this was supposed to be like Richard Stanley's return. This was supposed to be like
Mandy,
a bigger budget
thing
or whatever.
Like,
exactly.
Mandy was like this, but he had one scene in the bathroom.
This feels like a spiritual, but like that also feels cathartic and genuine.
This just feels
like goofy.
Like when he's in the car in this, having his freak out.
And then his wife's just like, oh, honey, like, I don't understand. I don't get it. And I understand, like, the whole, like, things need to get weird because that's the kind of movie this is.
Yeah.
But he can get weird in a way that isn't what we've seen over and over again. And it feels like, to the same extent that we saw in Mom and Dad, where he does the hokey pokey as he destroys the pool table, it's like, oh, this is happening because people want this in the trailer. That they're like, oh, did you see that? He sings the hokey pokey while he bashes a pool table. Like, you gotta see this movie. Like, here, it's just like, oh, he's doing this goofy voice while he's shotgun. Like, just...
I think it's tough because, especially at this point, like, I feel like he can't win. Like, I feel like he's trying to embrace some of that side of himself.
Which
that
is what has turned me against him.
Exactly, yeah. I think that's what's going on here. It's like, now that he's in on himself, basically, and playing into some of it. But I don't entirely believe that. Like, I think that's what people think. Those are some thoughts out there, but I don't think Richard Stanley would have told another actor to act like Nick Cage. I think Cage is doing what he does and getting to where he'd get in any other movie that required this of him, But I think that part of it is also that we are such aficionados at Cage, like who have seen Vampire's Kiss four or five times,
yeah.
that this is going to be different and new to people. And you know, he's going back to the well. I don't want to do too many well puns during this.
Do it.
He is doing that to a degree, maybe to, I don't know, maybe to appease a certain audience or not, but I don't feel that. And I'm kind of bummed that you do feel that way about it.
I wanted to love this movie so bad, and like, I love... Basically, the first, like, until he turns weird, and then basically once he's kind of removed from the movie, like, I am all about this. But there's, like, a 45-minute chunk in the middle where he's just, like, and, like, that's, it's okay, and then it just turns, and then I'm like, oh, I don't like this at all.
Hmm.
And it hurts me that I feel that way, but that's what I feel.
There are more subtly nuanced ways you could do his kind of descent into madness. It would have required maybe some more... characterization. We don't really get that from almost anyone of the family. Yeah, it's pulp. It's what I was expecting going into it. But as you were saying that, I realized a lot of my criticisms are kind of nitpicky familiarity because I'm too close with Lovecraft. So I think it's kind of the
adaptation,
same thing.
You think?
Part of that, but I think just being too close to the thing that I was there to see pulled me out of it a little bit, just kind of like Cage with you, is like you were too close to it at a certain point.
I will admit that part of the problem is that I have been looking forward to this for like a year, and then like literally for the last 6 months since the end of September, when people saw it at Fantastic Fest, they're like, you have to see this movie. And then for like, not that we have a huge listener base, but we've had multiple people who like listen to the podcast are like, when's the episode coming out? We need to know what you think. And I'm like, I feel like there's like this hype. There's this build-up that, like, this was supposed to be the thing. Like, even when our Cage chain, where we had, like, 6 months in a row or whatever, we're like, this is
going to
be the crowning jewel, right? This is going to be the one that, like,
turns out it was
Chef's
Primal.
Kiss.
No. I'm just kidding.
Score to settle, baby.
Score to settle.
But, like, I admit that the same joy that I have in A Score to Settle, where he is going crazy, is exactly the same reason that I don't like this. But I think in my head, I was expecting... better. I was all expecting right. more, because I felt it's... like this was supposed to be of a certain kind of film.
Like a certain caliber, a certain level
of elevated horror. Because it has the pedigree.
You're getting
like...
A24, man. Not every horror movie has to be
No, but
two
I don't want that, but
and...
I want, like, I just don't want the same nonsense that he seems to, like, especially over the last 2 years, right? Like, basically, I was looking, like, aside from Mandy, since we caught up, he has done... honestly kind of zero great movies. Like Army of One we love, but it's goofy. Like,
and
it's
it was
not
before Mandy anyway,
right, but I mean like
so,
but like yeah,
like,
since,
yeah
like,
you know, no I know what you're saying.
It's just disappointing.
It's weird. I feel like I'm right in between you two. Like, this hits such a sweet spot for me as far as Cage and Lovecraft. Like, what I love about it, just like even on a Cage and Lovecraft level, is like most of their work lately, Cage's stuff, like, usually is goofy, over the top, and out of control. Like, the last five movies we got this year that all went to video on demand, like, those are insane movies. You know
is
what
he
I'm saying?
On the, is he high on the Cage scale in those movies
yeah,
as well?
Yeah, he gets there in
but
every one of
I
them.
Think, so I think that's so, it. I think it's Overdose. I think this is the movie where he should have been high on the Cage scale, and the other is maybe he shouldn't have been, and that's what
but
is
that's,
maybe messing
I think
with you.
This is also, in a way, the culmination of that, where, like, those movies get made because... they have a $5 million budget or whatever, and he gets $4.5 million, and he has to overact because they have to be like, go see the movie where Nicolas Cage blank.
But
like,
this movie was riding on the name Lovecraft, not Nick Cage, you know, and Richard Stanley second even at that, and Cage probably third or second maybe. I love, you know, like From Beyond, Reanimator, and Dagon, but those movies are schlocky, okay? And it's hard to find like a serious, well-done Lovecraft movie, and I feel like this is it.
Which is why it bothers me here, because I think everything else is awesome. I love everything else about this, and I'm like...
But it's even one of the more pulled back performances, even if you go and watch like From Beyond, like everybody's acting like Nick Cage in that movie. Like it's like real madness.
What is that guy's name? Who was in that trilogy with Barbara Crampton and the actor? Reanimator as well. Jeffrey
Combs.
Yes, he is.
He's
at 10 on the Cage level in those movies, too.
I think that a lot of things sort of conspired in a way to make me dislike this. And it's a bummer. And, like, we were talking over lunch before we started recording this about movies that we watch that aren't what we expect, and then you sort of have to see the second time, and you, like, might be able to get it more. Like, you're like, oh, I now know what the movie's trying to do. I don't think that can happen to me here. Because, like, I get what the movie's trying to do. I think the movie's doing exceptionally well what it's trying to do. I just think that at the core of it is who ostensibly is my favorite actor going back to this thing that he has done more than once, and especially, like, in the last dozen movies.
Another movie I thought of heavily while watching this that takes a completely different directorial direction, but dealing with the same thing as like Annihilation.
Man, we have the same notes.
Oh my gosh!
No, I thought that because it looks
Look what they do. They're going insane, and they're really kind of like.
It's this weird cycle that Lovecraft is kind of unfilmable, especially doing direct adaptations. You look at Reanimator from Beyond, or even like some of the way worse versions of Lovecraft things, like the Necronomicon, a short story collection.
Which, by the way, this is also his. Richard Stanley wants to do two more Lovecraft adaptations.
Yes, I think they want to do Dunwich Horror, I believe, is one of them.
Dunwich Horror is going to come next.
Yeah, I'm very into that. But the best Lovecraft movies are taking the themes and the concepts and making them your own thing. And I think Annihilation is one of the best Lovecraftian movies ever. So since it already kind of was Color Out of Space, like this is almost a Color Out of Space. An Annihilation prequel. Like, this is the thing hitting, and what happens before the bubble blows out. Annihilation took from Lovecraft, made it its own thing. Other Lovecraft stuff that tries to hold itself to a higher standard almost feels derivative of the thing that was taken from Lovecraft in the first place. It's a tough cycle to break from.
It's even crazy because you just even said the word, the thing, and I thought of that several times because
there were dogs.
Yeah, and this must be where that originated from, the idea in the short story that animals were merging and blending together to create these weird things. And then you look at the thing that Carpenter did, and that's a total homage to Lovecraft, like even finding an alien in the Arctic, you know, and all that. And then just blending themes and imagery and all throughout all of his works and stuff. So it's really funny how like the sort of derivative works are almost better than the straight adaptations.
I agree. I think that the most you see this is actually where Lovecraft has kind of had his resurgence, or the resurgence started, and where it's kind of spiraled downward is in video games. Lovecraft video games really are, they don't get it.
Like, what are some examples?
Call of Cthulhu, there's two Call of Cthulhu games. One's called Dark Corners of the Earth, and the Call of Cthulhu game that just came out. And then the Sinking City just came out. Then you have games that are inspired by it, like Sunless Sea, Darkest Dungeon, games like that. If you look at some of the less good Lovecraft games, you would think that all Lovecraft is like green colors, very wet, drippy tentacles. Like, that is all Lovecraft is in a lot of the video games. Like, so much of Lovecraft is the themes of being an outsider, being afraid of the unknown. Yes, let's just touch on it real quick. Virulent racist, horrible human being. Lovecraft was a bad person.
Was he around the 1800s? When was he alive? 1920s.
1920s, okay. Is when he was doing a lot of his writing. But that informed a lot of his writing and a lot of the themes that carry through it. And he's not just tentacles and goop monsters. And that's why I think Annihilation is one of the best Lovecraft adaptations, because it deals with the change. It symbolizes the change within you, coming out of a traumatic process and being someone else and how you cope with that. This, there's not a lot of subtext. It's just like, you're a goop monster now.
I think what the issue is that I have here is what works in other Cage movies, and that what we talk about a lot on the Tom Hum podcast, on the Cruise Club and Hangs Some Memories, is that like by casting actor X in your movie, there's a shortcut. Right, like you cast Tom Cruise, you know what kind of movie it is. You cast Tom Hanks, you kind of know what kind of, and like you can stray. There's genres or whatever, but like by putting an actor that everyone knows and sort of has a type, even if they have multiple types, but like you have a shortcut. Like you don't need to define the character. I mean, you should, but you don't have to define the character as much because people know what a Tom Cruise character is like. They're handsome and they're confident and they're cocky and they're admired and all this different stuff. And like for good and bad, you have a baseline, and like you can either subvert that or you can like use that to like propel the character forward. And I feel like by casting Nicolas Cage here, to your point, they don't characterize at all, because it's just like, yeah, he's a crazy guy. You're gonna see him go crazy.
Yeah, but how much is anyone else really characterized throughout the film too? Which I think is a drawback in
general. There's no characters in
exactly.
The
but like, I think that's a drawback across the board.
Yeah. But I think that I don't mind that. And again, I don't mind the Cage character not really having characterization, because I get like there's the moments. It's just what I have issue with is his performance. If you put anyone else in the exact same things, I'd be like, yeah, all right.
Which is weird, because like he's the only one you're sort of asked to bring any knowledge of. Like, I don't recognize or know any of these other actors except for Chong, right, out in the woods. And like he's
I recognize both the brothers.
See, I couldn't recognize anybody. I didn't know. I mean, I know you guys.
Who's the brother from?
The older brother is the brother in The Guest.
The younger
brother is the glasses brother from Haunting of Hill House.
I haven't seen that yet. So the younger brother actually is the son of, I don't remember this character, but Cage apparently has a daughter in Drive Angry, and that actress, her son in real life is this kid.
Weird.
So
okay.
His mom acted with Cage 10 years ago, and now she acts with Cage, or he acts with Cage here.
But I guess my point is, like, no one else is bringing anything to the table the way, like, oh, you see Castaway with Hanks, and it's like, oh, I'm thinking of Hanks the whole time. It's like, here, I could see where it's like, oh, we casted Cage, like, we're thinking of Cage the whole time. He can't really disappear in this movie and reemerge as like a different character. You know, it's kind of tough. Like, I still love it, you know, but I'm just trying to get where you're at. I'm just trying to sort of...
I get what he's saying, though, with the shortcut. It's like Richard Stanley, Lovecraft adaptation, Nicolas Cage, lots of colors and ambient soundtrack. It's like short list or short track to the 2020 cult status. Mm-hmm. It's like, boom, you know who this is going for without anything but those five bullet points.
Yeah. Mm. And there's a lot of movies that I feel like, and I don't think this is one of them. I feel like this is almost on its own, but there's a lot of movies that try to be the Holy Mountain, right? That try to be like El Topo. That try to just like,
weird.
You guys like, you know, get stoned and like just watch this movie.
And just
and,
expand
like,
your mind, dude.
And it's like, yeah, okay. But then there's like the movies that actually, like, I feel like this is close, but like there's like a movie like Climax, like Gaspar Noé. Like Gaspar Noé is just like his own breed of whatever, but like Climax feels like a 90-minute or however long it is heart attack. Like,
I
I'm like,
hate
this,
that movie
this
that
is
reason.
A, it's a nightmare. I'm like, I feel sick to my stomach watching this and I can't look away. Yeah. Like there's movies that are able to somehow take like the thing that like, oh, like you need to see this experience, like you need to experience this, whatever, right? And they're able to like execute on that. And I feel like, I don't know that this ever would have gotten there. I feel like it would have gotten close, but just that what I bring to the table here.
Well, you know what's interesting is what did this really well, but sort of in reverse, and we mentioned it, I think, at lunch, is Uncut Gems, right? Is like, there's a movie that is just like a two-hour anxiety attack, right? And then it's like, wait, but Adam Sandler is like giving me this anxiety attack? Yeah. Like, how did that? And it's like all of these expectations have been immediately subverted, and now I'm even more anxious about what's going on. So I'm sort of like leaning closer to you here.
If it wasn't Nick Cage, we probably would have got the dad being played by John Travolta, though. They clearly wanted to go for goof a little bit, like that cult status. I think you're right about that.
But like, I think the other issue that I have with this, and I know this is my own breed of psychosis or whatever, is that I know that people are going to see this movie and be like, oh, there's that goofy Nick Cage. Like, I love this movie because look at him being... And like, that's what bothers me, because I feel like this gives credence to what we try to disprove.
Yeah.
I thought we disproved. I thought we did disprove. Other movies, it's like, he's a big game hunter on a boat, like hunting a white tiger in Primal. That's insane, but like, it's $1 million movie. Like, it doesn't, who cares? Like, nobody's gonna see Primal. This is a movie that, even though it's a cult movie that not a lot of people have seen, this is a movie that people were looking forward to, that this is like, has been billed as like the next great Nick, like the best Cage movie since Mandy, right? This is the one, the only one since Mandy in the last year and a half or whatever, that people are like, this is the one to see.
Yeah.
And I feel like people going to this are gonna have that confirmation bias, like, crazy Cage, I love it because look what he's doing here. And that, it bothers me that, because I know he can do more. We've seen him do more literally dozens of times.
Yeah.
We've seen him play other characters that aren't ham-fisted and over the top that we can see him do well, effectively, and yet he's not. He's just relying on things that he's done before. And I know that he's got more in the tank, I think, I hope.
Yeah.
But it just feels like, do that thing from Vampire's Kiss, do that weird voice you do. It just feels, I think, and a lot of this might just be the voice, because like, we've seen this voice.
Yeah, the voice is pretty dumb.
And the voice, he's done the voice in a couple other movies recently, too.
Yeah.
So like, why are you doing this other than just like, you want to be goofy?
Right, right, right. I mean, he brings about the voice to mock his own father, and then later he sort of like takes up the voice because he is... feels like he's become him to it. I'm just saying, story-wise, plot-wise, like, they've actually, it's not like he just comes out and like starts talking funny. It's like there's actually like a story reason for him to start doing the voice,
right?
But, and then, so I mean, I can understand, like, it didn't need to be Vampire's Kiss voice, but he had to do something there, like, even if it was Bogart, you know, which maybe I would have preferred him doing some more bogeys. But hopefully what I'm thinking this, and I agree with you too, I think like this was very much being looked forward to as like the next Cage movie. You gotta see, that'll prove to you it's what he, it's who he is and everything. And I think a lot of people are gonna watch this movie and not be impressed by it, to be quite honest with you. And I think that might be what is happening, where like Cage fans are like, yes, this is working, but other people are like, oh, like, I'm back on the other side of the fence now. I don't know that I do like Nick Cage if this is what he's all about. Like, I'm sort of sensing like that might actually start happening a little bit more, and it's gonna, you know, the wave is sort of gonna come back. Like, I feel like the tide is gonna roll back after this for a while, and people are sort of maybe not forget about him, but not be as like internet meme about him anymore for this.
I also feel like he has, like, nobody cares about Nicolas Cage anymore. There, I think there was like the time where like there's a couple years where like it was the meme, and now like the internet just moves too fast, and he's irrelevant. Like,
right,
and I don't say that condescendingly, because I mean, that's our,
no, but I mean,
our
it's
brand,
not like,
right?
Alpaca
status.
Yeah,
it's not like Alpaca is gonna be like, you know.
I want to talk about that really quickly.
Yeah,
okay.
Nicolas Cage is to the point where like any movie he's in, if he has some sort of eccentric idea for the character for the movie. He basically demands it, right? Like, the alpaca thing just seems like...
It's
like
the movie where Nicolas Cage milks an alpaca.
Which sounds like a fucking Cards Against Humanity card.
Yeah.
it's not a real sentence. But, like, I'm thinking of that... I don't remember the name of the movie that I was texting you about where you were like, it was atrocious. I was like, it was kind of fun. Where it's... Nick Cage plays, like, a mobster and basically doing the Andy Kaufman character.
Arsenal?
Yeah, it might be Arsenal.
Yeah, Arsenal with Vinny Chase?
Yes, yep. Yes, there we go.
Oh, yeah. Arsenal, is that... That's the sequel to...
That's sort of the pseudo-sequel yeah. to Downfall.
But he
yeah.
basically, Deadpool. Like, he wasn't told, like... he's like, you're going to play a mobster. And he came in, he's like, I'm doing... I want to call him Tony Montana. What the hell was the character that Andy Kaufman did?
Tony Clifton.
He's doing Tony Clifton in that whole movie. Like, he just gets to do weird eccentric shit if he comes up with Ghost Rider 2 or whatever, with the face and stuff like that. I feel like he also brought some weirdness to the movie on his own. And you're going to get that with Cage. It's like part of the deal is he's going to be like, no, all the horses in the script have to be alpacas. And you're just like, all right, Nick.
There's a certain thing where in both good and bad ways that I feel like almost as media and entertainment gets more fragmented, it feels like more things are getting made with nobody saying no. And I think that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Like, it feels mm-hmm. like no one said no to Quentin Tarantino in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's just like, hey, this is the movie. We're going to have Al Pacino talk about the beautiful of, like, the you know, the beauty of 35mm film in the beginning for 10 minutes because, like, fuck you, I love film, and, like, this is what we're... And it's just like, all right, cool. And then, like, you see the Amazon series Too Old to Die Young, where, like, no one told Nicholas Winding Refn no, and, like, the first three episodes,
it's amazing.
I'm like, why am I watching this? And I'm like, by the end, I'm like...
It's real time.
Thank you for saying, for never saying no, because like this is the most committed that anyone has ever been to a vision, and like I love how off-putting it is, because like by the end you're like, oh no, this is my favorite thing of all time. Then I feel like to a certain extent, like no one has told Cage no
yeah
in decades. Like, he needs someone, like he needs to go into like a Tarantino movie or something where like
yes,
he can be
exactly
be like, stop what you're doing,
you nailed
like
it.
You have something in there, you need someone like a stronger willpower than Nicolas Cage, which I know is hard to find now, but you need someone to be like, stop it, you're better than this.
Well, yeah, that's what he's sort of stuck in this age. This is what happened when he fell into like VOD land, you know, and now when he's sort of trying to come back out of it with films like this, and it's like Richard Stanley's not going to say no to Cage, you know what I'm saying? Like, and it's not like you're not going to get him to do, but like, you're right, it's going to take a Tarantino or like, you know, Spielberg or like Scorsese or someone that's going to have to come up and be
or
like,
or even
hey.
You or like the Safdie brothers, just like what they
right.
do. Just like,
right.
just like stop someone... it. Like, you're not bigger than...
I think
like...
he probably got reined in Mandy a little bit. Not entirely, because he did yeah. still do like those weird Bruce Lee faces every now and then. But I think he was reined in a little bit in that movie.
Which is why that works.
Yeah.
Which
but
is
I
why,
also
like, these
feel
two
like
are...
that might have been, like you're saying, that could have come from him too, where he's like, in this one, I'm going to be subtle as possible or whatever. Or
that's what happens when you have like four divorces and bought dinosaur bones and a sarcophagus and a period to be buried in, is you gotta do these, you gotta do every single movie
I just
that
feel
comes
like
across your desk.
In an era where there are so many filmmakers who are basically like breaking actors, like you hear from the set of The Lighthouse, like Robert Pattinson wanting to literally punch Robert Eggers in the face because he is like making him stand outside in the pounding rain mm-hmm. and do the scene over and over again, almost to like a Kubrickian or like a David Fincher level. But then you see the movie, you're like, oh, he it was mm-hmm. for a purpose. Like,
right,
it works.
Right, right.
You have people like this, which is like, oh, yeah, like, Nick, like, what the story that I talk about a couple times, like, when I saw The Trust at South by Southwest, rest in peace, South by Southwest, the directors were on stage, and they were talking about how, like, when you get Nicolas Cage in your movie, that's where your budget goes to. But the other side is that, like, when you have Nicolas Cage in your movie gets distribution. And I feel like there's so many people, especially, you know, either up-and-coming directors or people who have not made a movie in 20 years, that they're like, oh, this is my chance to have eyes on my movie. I don't want to do anything to, like, have him walk off or not want to do press or whatever. And I feel like... I don't know if he has any interest in being told no, and I think that's a bummer.
Yeah,
of the movies, he's got like eight or something movies that are still to come, right? And like, there's two that everybody's looking forward to. There's one that I'm really looking forward to, which is The Prisoners of the Ghost Land, which is like his first.
Yeah. But then there's Jiu-Jitsu, which looks really good.
But is it
going to
be good, or is it going to be like
it
there's
like,
certain movies that the kind of director that has a clout, and like he might tell Nicolas Cage no.
Or Cage will just do whatever he said, right? Like he'll have the reverence of being like, I'm working with a master.
Yeah, that might be part of it. Cage respecting the director enough to.
But he doesn't respect Richard Stanley, I guess?
Well, maybe he does, but Richard Stanley is just too much of a fanboy to be like, to say like that, you know, do this instead, do that instead.
I just feel like I get that, but I feel like in this era where we have Nicolas Cage about to play himself in a movie and recreate scenes from his life,
is that
like
happening?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, you don't know about that?
Oh no.
Coming out next year, I think he's playing. It's called The Unbearable Weight of Talent or something like that.
Unbearable
where he plays himself.
That's an awesome adaptation of Nick Cage.
He's playing himself. and he's they're recreating film scenes from past.
He's sort
of
having like a
are they
going to
tarkin
crisis?
His face like so he looks like young and plastic?
I don't but know. That's I a good am, idea. They're gonna.
I am terrified. This movie.
They're
gonna
Irishman him.
I think this movie is going to be very bad.
And I'm sort of on the other side where it's like I'm very much looking forward to this because
this
I feel
be
like it's going to be all at once, like everything he can do.
This might be the most head-ass Nick Cage, though. Like, just completely self-serving Ouroboros Nick Cage face eating Nick Cage face.
Could it break it? Like, could it break him and go from 5 or 6 video-on-demand movies a year to, like, none or maybe one? And, like, is that going to start... Is his star going to start finally fading? Like, is that something that'll do it?
His star is faded.
Yeah, he's in, like, the Cameron Mitchell point of his career.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I just have these blinders on because we do this show that, like... I feel like I have a problem because maybe I'm in this area where it's like he can't do anything wrong right now. Like having him in a Lovecraft movie, any Lovecraft movie to me feels like perfect. Like, you know, so that's why I'm kind of bummed that you didn't enjoy it as much.
It's not only that I didn't enjoy it, it's that like he expressly kept me from enjoying it, which is like the bigger issue. Like it hurts.
Never thought
me.
I'd hear that.
Can we talk a little bit about the movie outside of Cage?
Sure,
is that cool?
Oh, yeah.
I think there's some really good stuff in there.
I also do want to say that the daughter, I told you this before,
she's great.
Is played by, from the Netflix hit smash movie To All the Boys I Loved Before, Lana Condor's boyfriend's ex-girlfriend.
Of course, that classic character.
Like, she's good in those two movies. Like,
she's very good.
She hasn't been in stuff, and, like, she's cool. And I feel like my one issue, and maybe this can bridge into something, or maybe it can't, but I think my issue with the movie, kind of, is that it has a protagonist problem.
Okay.
And that it starts out, it feels like it's her movie. Like, we see her first.
Yes.
And then we think it's maybe the Hydrologist movie. And then it kind of becomes Nicolas Cage's movie, because how can he be on screen and it's not his movie? And then all of a sudden it becomes the May, like, then just the town's movie, like, and then becomes the Hydrologist again. Like, I feel like it never sticks with someone, and I feel like the wildly different points of view both work and hold it back. And I think that the daughter is really fascinating. I think the Hydrologist, like, when he's out in the woods, like, things are going weird, that's interesting too. But it's like, well, why are we here? Like, we should be at the house. That's another thing that I have issues following.
That's a Lovecraft adaptation problem.
Have you read the short story?
Yes, I actually reread it for
Is it told from
this.
One person's perspective?
Okay, so it is told from a Hydrologist perspective.
That is
the thing. They're going to flood the region to make a new reservoir, like in the movie.
Okay.
He goes to the town, and the town is like, yeah, we don't go there. It's called the Blasted Heath. It is just basically what we see at the end of the movie with the white expanse,
like
flattened plains. Yeah. They say, like, you know, stuff's bad. We don't talk about the dark times around here anymore. This Hydrologist goes out there. They're like, well, there's one guy who still lives out in the margins of the area. He's basically squatting there. He was there. He'll talk about it.
Is that the Tommy Chong character or the Cage?
So it is... I think that's what the Tommy Chong character is supposed to be, but it's not the same. So the Hydrologist goes there, and then the entire story is this squatter telling him the story of this family from 40 years ago.
Oh.
It's like a first-person account that is being told in third... Yeah, it's weird.
Because it feels like the Tommy Chong character... has zero purpose in this movie.
Yeah, he doesn't have much purpose.
I don't know.
I enjoy his character, but like he's there to give
the
son
the
lead.
Well, I think like he's pretty thematic, right? Like, you know, there's a lot of psychedelics and things like that going on in this movie, and I think he represents, you know, they even said like Cage, the daughter even said like he did too much acid in the 60s or whatever. Like, I think they're trying to set up a lot of like freaky deaky kind of stuff and like that kind of thing. And Tommy Chong comes out with a lot of like not the themes of the movie, but a lot of what the speculation as to what is going on, you know.
He's
like
good in it too.
Yeah, and like the way I like the portrayal of like how he's like, they're aliens that came down on the rock, but they're like in the atmosphere or in the airwaves, and like just trying to sort of understand that is very difficult for me, but I enjoy it. And at the end when he's like, they're making our world like theirs, but we can never understand that, like, I'm digging why he's here. I wish there was actually a little more of him. I feel like he needed an extra scene maybe, and I can't believe Cage never interacted with him once. Like, he's living on his property and we never get a scene between the two of them.
I think that just goes back to the, like, they don't know how to tell two timelines in a single timeline, right? Because it's like, we need this character because, to your point, like, he elucidates the themes of the movie, even though you kind of get it. I feel like you don't lose anything if he's not in it.
Okay.
Maybe things are a little bit more obscure, you have to think a little bit more, but like, you're gonna get
I love
the
final
anyway.
Shot of him, at least, when they go into his trailer at the end and see what he's sort of become. Like, I think that really puts a nice point on things for me, anyway. But
yeah.
More so than actually seeing, like, other worlds and other dimensions. You know, like, that was great stuff, too, but I was sort of like, didn't really need to go that far.
So the story the movie tells is the same as the short story, except
it's
very kind of
it's maybe the closest Lovecraft adaptation, because...
Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I think so. Reanimator is pretty long, but it definitely, the movie goes off, way off of that. From Beyond is very short, maybe like 6 pages, so they really had to expand.
Benjamin Button's a 25-page short story, that's a 3-hour movie, right?
Well, so like, and then there's people who take a 150-page Great Gatsby and have to add the horrible bullshit to it and ruin the movie.
But anyway, yeah, but Leo dances.
But, you know, so this I think is one of the closest Lovecraft adaptations. There's a couple little changes, though they don't matter to me. It was three, he had three sons. There's no aspect of, like, the whole witchcraft thing, I guess. Okay. Kind of talking about that is interesting, because that seems very, that felt very un-Lovecraft to me, bringing in this concept of, like, religions from our world that we understand, even though she's, so this, two things that kind of come together. So many Lovecraft references, like all of the Lovecraft references you expect. He plays all the hits. Miskatonic University
shirt.
Arkham. The 7-day forecast for Arkham, Innsmouth, and Dunwich. Like,
oh, I know, all on the TV screen.
Yeah, so you're hitting all of that. She has a copy of the Necronomicon in paperback.
She uses it.
Yeah, well, good for Abdul Hazarat for getting published in paperback. It's a lot cheaper probably than binding books in human skin at this point.
Well, it makes you think of, like, you know, they didn't want to publish the new Woody Allen biography. Like, they're still making Necronomicon and stuff.
And she uses it, too. And I guess I kind of want to also talk about the ending and your interpretation of it. In the story, the hobo, whatever you want to call him, the weird guy, the Tommy Chong-esque character, comes back to town because they're finding weird shit in the woods, and they go back there with a couple of people and police, and they basically see the family completely, like, done, like, decomposed. They do the attic stuff, they talk about that, but by this point, you know, the family lives in the well, essentially, except for the cage guy, who is actually just, like, he just disintegrates in front of them. And so at the very end, like, there's no, like, whatever we'll talk about, there's no her going Super Saiyan or whatever like that in this short story, this everything starts going bad, and it seems like the aliens are leaving, and they just run. This character looks back. He's the only one that looks back, and it's kind of like Lot from the Bible.
Gomorrah, yeah.
He looks back, and he, like, loses it, because everyone sees the aliens going back into space. He sees that some of it stays in the well. So he's the only one with the knowledge that, like, it's still here. And
he, the hydrologist.
Yeah. No, the Tommy Chong. And then he tells that to the hydrologist, and that's how we get the whole, like, they're under the reservoir, but I'm never drinking the water. That's, like, straight out of the story. So that's how that ends. The aliens just get their shit and leave. This has this whole aspect of, I interpreted it in a way. How did you interpret what happens at the end?
I basically figured that they took off. Not, man, leave is, I don't know exactly. Like, okay, so she definitely opened up, like, a portal so that more could come. That's what I was thinking. I was like, this is like the end of Howard the Duck. Like, the Dark Overlords are coming down, and they're going to inhabit, and they're going to take over the place.
You shot an arrow straight through my heart.
What, with the Howard the Duck?
Well, that's just that's a lyric from the song.
Oh, well. Yeah, I was like, okay, they're coming down, they're going to inhabit and everything, but then there's, like, this huge explosion, so, like, maybe they were leaving after all? I wasn't really sure, but I was at a point at that where I didn't really care. I was like, I'm not really supposed to be able to comprehend what's happening here. That's what I was in for, you know, and I was, like, fine with that kind of thing. So I'm not even crystal clear on, like, what my reading, like, what exactly happened there. And I don't know how the one kid survived out of that entire blast. Like, the water guy was left behind, like, completely unharmed and everything. But I gotta say, I had, like, a hell of a fun time watching it, like, watching her, like, go, like, all purple and the wormhole open up and everything. But I almost thought they could have just ended it there when that exploded, and then just been, like, try and put it together, you know, like, on your own.
I think it might be, like, metaphorical, like, she just sort of I don't know, like,
if there was more symbolism and subtext to that ending, I think I would not mind, but it just, this movie just seems like pure plot, Lovecraft greatest hits. Like, it didn't seem like there was any, I was wondering if I missed some sort of symbolism other than, like, you know, a very vague environmental message that this movie has. Yeah, I didn't see metaphor in that ending. I was wondering if
I don't know that it, I don't know that there is, but I'm just thinking that, like, if it doesn't happen, because I didn't think of that until you said that it doesn't happen in the book, and then I'm wondering if, like, if it actually happened, or she's just, like, instead of him, like, running away and looking back or whatever, if she's just showing him, like, what could be. You know what I mean? Like, I don't...
It's tough, because I remember sitting at the end. I remember sitting through watching this going, like, okay, like, what are, like, the overarching themes? Like, is it an environmental thing? Like, you know, they're out there in the woods, but, you know, if my Herzog has taught me anything, is that the, you know, nature is lethal. Like, it doesn't matter. It will kill you. But this thing isn't quite nature. It's from space. So it's like, okay, is it science versus witchcraft, or, like, is it nature versus science? Is there something like that going on? But no, I don't. Ultimately, I don't think that's a theme.
It's a muddied message.
Either.
Yeah. Yeah. And from a plot perspective, I felt like he was doing very like Lovecrafty kind of like the modern interpretations of Lovecraft that kind of come from like the games and the role playing game, which is very much pervaded like Lovecraft in general. Where it's like it seemed like she cast like the spell from the Necronomicon, right? And she has the rune on her. Like she basically says she prays to a deity. And she says, like, protect me and take me away from here. The interpretation I got out of it, which I think is me kind of adapting some of Lovecraft's themes onto it, was as the color is expanding its fullest, it takes her, and whatever god... Because the gods in the Lovecraft universe are not all, like, working together. Like, they're all, like, kind of either ambivalent or don't like each other. So I think, like, whatever god she prayed to was like, okay, no, I hear your wish. And you get a little, like, Wishmaster reporting for duty, where instead of, like, it protects her... She's not absorbed by it. It just, like, oblivion is better. And it just pretty much, like, you got your wish and just, like, poof.
So I like that a lot because I remember there's lots of, like, sorcery and stuff, right? In Lovecraft, like, it's not so much witchcraft, but it's, like, summoning and...
A lot of cult stuff.
Yeah, a lot rituals. Of that culty stuff. And I was sort of getting that just from the opening shot of her doing her little, like, breast cancer ritual thing for her mom and everything like that. So I do like that. And I also noticed, and I think this came up big in like, From Beyond and I think some other stuff, like the pineal gland, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, like, opening up your third eye and all that. And she has that drawn on. And at the end, it actually, like, shimmers and opens up. And it happens to a couple other characters, too, and stuff. So, like, I'm down with that interpretation. I just think, like, the issue is, like, you're so well-versed in Lovecraft that you could sort of decipher that from what's going on.
And I think I'm throwing it on to that. I think I'm maybe adding a little of that.
But I don't think that it's not to say that it's not there, either. It's just that there's a lot... This movie is very cryptic, right? Like, and it could probably benefit from being a little more straightforward.
But it also feels too straightforward.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of neither, right? Like, because I think that...
Because I think when the kid's like, oh, I'm talking to my friend in the well, and he's just whistling, I'm like, well, what is... I don't get that, really.
I hated that.
Yeah, and all the high... And like you're saying with the smelling and stuff, like, I feel like these are things that could be... like, you could give a clear-cut thing as an explanation to something somewhere.
But I also feel like, I don't know if that's the Lovecraft or the... Or Richard Stanley or whatever, they're just like, yeah, we're not going
to
tell you.
Well, this is why Lovecraft is so hard to adapt, is you get a couple of... The whole Lovecraft is like, things you cannot possibly comprehend... That when you see them, you immediately lose your mind. The color out of space in the story is not this bright Nicholas Winding Refn pink. It's like it's a color that's literally not on our spectrum, and you can do that.
Wait, because the color is pink or purple or magenta or whatever. And like apparently it's not on the normal scale. Like it's some kind of comedy or whatever. But like the mayor and the news vans come up and they're just like, "What color is he?" He's like, "It's kind of pink." Actually, there's no color.
Yeah,
that I'm, but it's like no, you can't say it's not a color that you've never seen before because it's pink. We all know that, like, we see that as pink. Like, I guess writing is going to allow you to, like, it's always the thing that you don't see is scarier,
That's
right?
why he's unadaptable, yeah.
Which is almost why, like, in Annihilation, to bring it back to that, like, the nightmare bear with the two mouths, like, by keeping it sort of simple, you're like, oh, god damn, like, what is happening here? And, like, you hear, sort of hear it speaking with a human voice, but also not, and it's like, you're not sure what you're seeing here, just like, oh, no, that's pink. Like, why are you saying that you can't identify the color? Like, that's pink.
And then the other kind of, I guess, Lovecraftian maybe thing we get is the merger of the two characters, which is really horrifying, and it's a unique visual. I guess that may be kind of the thing, because we already get that, but I think the sound that it makes, really horrifying, but then it turns into, like, a thing monster.
It's a spider person.
And a lot of the stuff in the house is, like, relying on these familiar, like, ghost story or exorcism tropes that we, like, have kind of seen, and, like, they don't belong here. It's because you just can't do that much with a visual interpretation of Lovecraft without falling back on things that you do know because it's so unknowable. And I think that kind of actually hurts the last 15 minutes of the movie for me until the well part.
So I actually, where does this fall in terms of like rating or in terms of how you feel about it?
I watched with a friend and he had very, very similar ideas and reactions to it that I did. A little bit disappointed by the ending, enjoying it up until a certain point, enjoying like a very slow burn and odd pacing, but feeling it and vibing with it. He has less Lovecraft knowledge than me, though. And he was like, B+, and I was like, B-. But I think if I just had less knowledge, I probably would have put out a B+. I think I'm a little too close to the material. I'm expecting too much. I'm expecting that you can't do it, honestly, at this point, especially just pure adaptation. So I enjoyed it. I think it's the best Lovecraft adaptation that is a straight out of his story. Like, this pulled from the playbook.
Because I think
it's better than From Beyond. It's better than Reanimator.
Because I haven't seen those movies.
They're good.
And
they're
I think the only thing that I know, like, when you say Lovecraftian, all I think is, like, weird hybrid animals. Like, that's all that I know. And so, like, when it happens, like, oh, I get that. Like, the weird fusing. Like, seeing it is, like, crazy. But then, like, when she's, like, when he's, like, feed your mother, double entendre.
Actually, like, Alien, the first Alien movie, is, like, a Lovecraft story, basically. Yeah. Like, that's like, the Mountains of Madness. Like,
okay.
It's pretty much like that. Like, we're going to this, it's basically dealing with the unknowable and not being able to, like, comprehend and kill it. All of the sort of character traits that emerge in people when confronted with such kind of crisis and, you know,
yeah, just
knowledge.
Wonder, like, I wonder where I would fall if Lovecraft stuff doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
Well, but then, like you've been, like you said earlier when I was pointing my thing, is that, like, I'm held back in another perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I guess it's, like, kind of four classes. There's, like, what you're held back by, what I'm held back by, people held back by neither, and then people who, like, lean into both, and that's
It's weird, because when I think of Lovecraft, I think of fish fuckers, for some
reason. Yeah. that's the thing I was talking about.
Like,
everything
Shape
is just,
of
like,
Water.
Fish.
Shape of Water.
Shape of Water is a great Lovecraft adaptation, or a Lovecraft inspired one, too, as well.
But, like, I think, yeah, like, mutant people praying to ancient gods, and just, like, you think you know, and you never, you know, you're never going to know. You know, basically the last shot of Indiana Jones 4, where the alien just goes, here's all the knowledge in the universe, and your brain explodes.
Oh, you mean the best Indiana Jones movie?
Mutt Williams.
For life.
There's a really good and obscure Lovecraft movie called Cthulhu that has absolutely nothing to do with Cthulhu.
Cool.
It's super low budget. It is maybe like 2008.
Is it black and white?
It is not. That is just a fan version of Call of Cthulhu, and that is terrible.
Okay, that's the one I think I ripped off Netflix way back when.
This is maybe a really good way to do modern Lovecraft and hit the themes. It's about a gay man whose mother dies, and he goes back to see his estranged family, who is very religious, and to, like, help make plans. And it's a small religious town. They don't like him. He doesn't want to be there, but he feels like he has to be. So a lot of those outsider feeling like you're not yourself, those themes that Lovecraft kind of, those are the adaptable themes, I guess is what I'm trying to say. The human themes that Lovecraft, in all of, like, his own neuroses and xenophobia, like, put into his work, is actually the stuff that's most adaptable today. With, like, in 2008, it was probably you know, religious anti-gay kind of metaphor. Today you can do trans stuff. There's now it's almost more relevant, but they're still just doing the goopy stuff, and that's what bugs me the most. I think,
yeah,
is that it's there, but they're whiffing. They're taking the plush Cthulhu and the Miskatonic U stuff, and
yeah, I think then that's like the mainstream kind of conception of Lovecraft, are the monsters. It's like monster stuff, but, like, not like what you're saying, or it's like the core of it, the outsiders.
They're not going deep enough.
I mean,
or they're
misreading
it.
It's funny that there are plush Cthulhus and things. It's like, who wants a Yogg-Sothoth plush doll or something like
and
that?
And I mean, I'm guilty of it. I have an Elder Sign tattoo. Like, I definitely play into a lot of those pop culture tropes of Lovecraft too, because I play the RPG. I love it. I'll get most Lovecraft games if they're decent.
I've watched you played one.
Yeah.
we struggled through one thing on Twitch.
And I mean, my Twitch right now, we're going through a bunch of indie Lovecraft inspired games, and it's there, but there is a personal aspect to Lovecraft that is entirely missed by almost every adaptation, except, you know, that one random movie, which is basically a reinterpretation of Shadow over Innsmouth, but using those themes, and Annihilation. I think those are maybe the only two that have gotten close. I guess maybe where I'm disappointed is that this didn't have any subtext or Lovecraftian concepts. The short story doesn't as much either, but yeah, there's just so much more you could do, and they didn't, but it's a good story in and of itself. I'm disappointed in the same way I'm disappointed with any Lovecraft adaptation, but this is still the best one, is kind of what I was trying to get at, I guess.
I think we mentioned to each other before going on the air that there's actually other versions of this story have been filmed. I would like to seek out one or two of those at some point and just see, you know, the limitations of the times and the ways that he's been adapted through the years and how close and on the mark any of that stuff is.
You mentioned, I don't want to steal your thunder on this one, I looked up that there was Die Monster Die with Boris Karloff was an adaptation of it, and 1987's The Curse, starring Will Wheaton. I want to call him Wesley Crusher because I can't remember. That's all I know him as. I want to see that because I want to see how close it is. And there's been, like, weird Lovecraft adaptations. There's, like, a couple of weird 50s Corman, like, versions of Case of Charles Dexter Ward and stuff like that. Dunwich Horror. Viewpoint Out was probably one of the more well-known adaptations of it, if you're
so
a horror
crazy
head at all.
Creepshow, right? I think it's the second story, the Stephen King one. What was the name?
Strange Death of Jordy Merrill.
Yeah, so that's basic. Have you seen that, Joey? No. Creepshow Part 1?
It's Stephen King's bar cover version of Color Out of Space, essentially.
Yeah, basically a rock lands in a farmer's backyard, and the growth spreads all over, including himself, until it's covered everything, and then he just blows his own head off. Mm-hmm. But it's basically, yeah, it's basically Color Out of Space, like, yeah, the, you know...
Okay.
Super straightforward. I would recommend it. I mean, if we're
this movie.
Yeah, if we're talking about people who are curious about what Cage Club wanted, granted, I'm not a Cage Club regular, but I would recommend this movie if you're curious about Nick Cage, Lovecraft, you know, Richard Stanley, neon horror, any combination of that. Like, this is worth watching.
I think it's worth watching. I just don't think it's anywhere near what it could have been.
Hmm. And for different reasons, I completely agree with you.
If you could only watch one, or if you could only tell people to watch one, this or Mandy, would you say? Is there any reason to say this one over Mandy?
No.
Like, I think in everything that this is trying to do, like, they're sister movies.
Mandy made me feel something, so on that alone.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mandy's, in a weird way, that's, like, even more unique. You know, this is an adaptation that came from nothing, and it's insane, right? So, like, I think just edges it out a little bit.
So maybe I would like this more if I watched on mute with subtitles, because, like, the colors, the effects are all gorgeous. I don't hear Cage's stupid accent. I think maybe I never
would have imagined that coming out of your mouth. Like, I'm so floored today. Cage's stupid accent, like...
But, like, we've heard...
Chris, you're here for a milestone.
I know. I was working on my Cage impression in the car just to see if I was going to bust out, and I realized that my Cage impression is just, like, a really bad mashup of...
Wait, is that what you said when you got here? You're like, I have something to do in the car? I was just using the car, like, practicing your Cage accent?
No. But I realized my impression is just, like, a mixture of Jimmy Stewart and Jodie Foster.
Well, okay, because his voice, like, he's so inspired by Jimmy Stewart and by Bogart and, like, everything. Like,
yeah.
He's got a couple of voices that he's done. He's done this Vampire's Kiss voice. Mm-hmm. He does the Charlie Baudel in Peggy Sue Got Married,
yeah,
which is kind of the, like, Mickey Mouse almost kind of voice,
yeah,
sort of.
Pretty much called
the
Mickey Mouse.
And then he's got
voice.
The classic old-timey,
yeah, like the Humphrey Bogart stuff.
And then he's got his own voice. So, like, he's gone to these wells, and I feel like recently, not that Dog Eat Dog is a great movie, but at least at the end there, where, like, things have broken very badly, and, like, he has lost... Mm-hmm. I understand that what I'm saying here as, like, why it makes sense is also, like... It feels counterintuitive why this doesn't make sense to me. But, like, in Dog Eat Dog, like, where he's driving that old couple at the end, and he's, like, acting like Humphrey Bogart because he's, like, in a dream sequence because he's lost basis with reality. And I know that he's lost basis with reality here, but I just feel like that was maybe the first time we'd seen something. I feel like if he just made a different acting choice, like, I don't mind that he's going over the top. I just mind that, like, he's doing the same thing that we've seen
he's
done
revisiting,
before.
Yeah.
And he's also done it a couple times recently in, like, clearly decidedly lesser things.
Yeah. No, it's true. I can't argue with that. It doesn't bother me. I actually kind of, like, I kind of liked it. You know, all I can say is, like, I feel like what he's doing is at least appropriate to the material, whereas he's been in other movies doing the same stuff, and it's not, it doesn't belong there, right? So at least, like, it fits the package. And I understand why it's bothering you, because, like, there was an opportunity to do something else, but then, you know, it would have been not a completely different movie, it would have been a very different movie, you know? It would have been directed entirely different, like... I don't think you would have gotten the wormhole and as much crazy effects at the end either. Like, I think it just wanted to go big or go home, and it went as big as it could in every direction, and I'm kind of glad it did.
I'll watch the next Richard Stanley Lovecraft one.
Is he trying to do, like, a whole sort of...
three.
Because I know James Wan also was circling the Dunwich horror. Is that...
Do people love this because they love it, or people love this because they're, like, they have the hubris of, like, I can adapt what's never been adapted?
He's one of the most influential horror writers of all time, and science fiction writers. Guillermo del Toro, I think he did Shape of Water, and it's so Lovecraftian because he had At the Mountains of Madness in development hell for, like, 10 years.
You know,
Tom Cruise was attached to
it. Tom Cruise was going
to
do it. It's crazy. And then Ridley Scott was going to do it, and he couldn't, so he went and he made the Alien Prometheus movie, and that was supposed to be sort of like
his... I can see that.
Oh, I couldn't make Mountains of Madness, so I went in and did it. I sort of interpreted it into that movie.
Like, I just feel like I would have liked this more, and I know that this never would happen because I don't think the budget is there, but, like, imagine if Tom Cruise was in this leading role and see him melt down in the same way. Like, something that we've seen maybe before, but not a lot. I just feel like Cage is doing what people expect him to do.
Or even Hanks, maybe, now that I think about it. Hanks would have fit.
Literally any other actor making the same choice.
Has he ever been in a horror movie?
No.
I think I've asked you this.
His very first movie, and that was it.
I think I asked you this on the Mazes and Monsters episode.
He knows you're alone.
Yeah.
I just feel like there's so many different actors. Like, you have Keanu here, like, his meltdown in Knock Knock, the cinematic accomplishment Knock Knock.
God, I hated that movie.
It was
just
free,
the free
fucking
pizza. I'm not a big fan of Pete Davidson, but I like Hot Ones, and he's like, that line made me a Keanu fan. I was like, all right.
But I just feel like there's so many actors who could have played this role and had the same kind of meltdown, and I just feel like even not knowing what to expect other than, like, just weirdness,
mm-hmm.
I feel like I would have been less disappointed if someone else did the same exact thing. Because it just feels, oh, you gotta see this movie, Cage is crazy. But like, okay, I get it. There's not a single thing he does here that we haven't seen before.
You're right. But, I mean, I can't argue with that. But all I can say is, like, I feel like it fits and it's working, whereas you don't. Like,
yeah.
I mean, there's no reason to really defend it except everything you're saying, but the opposite. You know, like, yeah. There's a part in this movie where he's like, why don't you get the fuck out of my face? And then he's like, no. Mm. He's like, I'll save you the trouble and I'll get out of yours. You know, and he's doing, like,
yeah.
those extended lines and he's singing opera.
Yeah,
and
I hated that.
And I'm loving it. And I loved it.
All right, so what we have to do, we started doing this, I think, last episode, possibly Grand Isle. You've played before. Actually, you might not have played before, because I think when you were on Cage Club Revisited, when we did this, it was before we had Cage Club Bingo. But we have Cage Club Bingo,
okay.
where we have like 75 things or something that are like in every Cage movie.
Okay.
And so we're trying to find the most Nicolas Cage movie, which I guess, to this movie's credit, might be that movie, and it's bad. Like, we don't want to, you know what I mean? Like, so, okay. So let's go through it all. And see if there are...
It's like golf. A lower number is better.
Well, I don't know. We don't know what the rules of this are. But just to go quickly, because we've talked about most of the things already, but is there a Cage Club Podcast Network crossover? Has anything about this really, like, actor or director or style... And I don't know. I think this is kind of... It stands on its own, right? There's not really...
Pretty much.
A woman is attacked. Yes, for sure.
Yep.
Accentuating an oddly specific word. Yes, for sure. Mm-hmm. Adaptation. Yes. Airplane or airport.
No.
An attractive woman finds Cage irresistible. Yeah, I mean, they're married, but yeah.
Mm.
All right, let's skip that. Another movie plays in this movie.
Yeah, they're watching that Marlon Brando film, which I thought was funny because Brando got Richard Stanley fired.
Awkward sex scene, yes.
Yeah.
It's like kissing her neck on the porch.
I was going to ask you, was there a sex scene in the Nicole Kidman one I watched with you?
Trespass?
Yeah.
Not between her and Cage, but
it's
between
Cage?
Her and the pool boy.
Okay, so then this was my first Cage sex scene, and honestly... As it was happening, that was more of an Eldritch abomination to me than I was, like, genuinely afraid of a full-on Nick Cage sex scene. I was really afraid I was going to get a full one, and I did not want.
Bad accent, yes.
Yeah.
Bad CGI, no. This is great
CGI. I love that.
And great practical effects, too. Let's not leave that out. That abomination with the mother and the son is awesome.
Billiards or bowling, no.
No.
Cage compromises woman, has sex with, yes. Cage cries.
Yeah. Pretty sure.
Yeah.
Cage dies, yes.
Yeah.
Cage drinks alcohol,
yep.
The whole movie.
Yep.
Cage drives, yes.
Yeah.
Cage eats, yes. Cage freaks out, yes. Grunts, yes. Has a visible tattoo.
No.
Is in jail, no.
Nope.
He's not a producer, this is not a Saturn Films. I mean, this is sort of like his home away from home almost. Like, Spectrevision's kind of becoming his second. He's exasperated / a broken man. Yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
On screen with an animal. Hello, alpaca. On the phone, yes. Even though they can't really connect. Is shirtless, no.
No, he's in the shower.
Oh, he is in the shower.
Yeah, he is.
Top build, yes. Laughs maniacally, yes. Shaves, no.
No.
Smokes or does drugs,
no.
Well,
no, right?
They talk about him doing acid, but he doesn't actually.
Yeah,
well, they're talking about.
She does mention that he was a hippie, but we don't see it.
Stands on something weird. Not really.
No.
Not in the history.
Surprisingly not.
Does he run?
Probably.
I think so, probably. Steals something.
Not
no.
Really.
Mm-hmm. Stutters or hesitates, yes. Voiceover? No. There's a voiceover at the end, but it's not
Cage's. It's not Cage's.
Does he wear a hat?
I can't remember him wearing
a
hat.
So.
Does he work out? No. Does he have multiple names? No. Yeah. Crazy eyes? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Dancing? This is not just necessarily Cage dances. Does anybody
I
dance?
Was it this one? No.
I think so.
Dramatic tonal shift? Yeah. That's kind of par for the course. Elvis or the Beatles? No.
No.
Explosions? Yeah, I mean, the thing...
Explosion of energy.
Well, also the thing landing outside is basically like a sonic...
And the lightning, that was a really cool scene where it's absorbing all the lightning. That's straight out of the book as well.
Extreme facial expression, yes. Flashback, no. Even though it feels like the whole short story is a flashback, this is not. Gambling, no. GIF-worthy scene, my point exactly, the whole fucking movie.
I think him eating the spoiled fruit could be a GIF.
Well, we're going to get there. Gold, no. There's nothing gold here.
I don't know.
I like every other color. Helicopter, no. Holiday setting, no. Las Vegas, no. Magic mysticism, yes.
Yeah.
Montage, no.
No.
New Orleans, no. This is in Arkham, wherever Arkham's supposed to be.
Northeast.
Nudity, him shirtless, but not really. This is
no nudity.
Overreaction, yes. Overt sexism, no.
I don't think so.
This actually, for the most part, kind of treats the women well.
Yeah.
Fruit, i.e. peaches or bunnies, yes. When he says
peaches,
I was like, all right, I guess. Nice redoing. Red sports car, no. Religion or spirituality, yes. School, no. Singing.
Yes, he sings in the car for a second. I wrote down opera.
Oh, yeah.
Someone Makes a Threat, yes. Plays a Musical Instrument?
No.
Someone Returns from Another Cage Film? No. Subtitles or non-credit text? No. The Beach? No. Time Jump?
Yeah.
Kind of.
Well,
right.
Yeah,
well, we lose sense of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is out of time and space.
Titular line spoken? Yes.
Mm-hmm. It is, yeah.
Twin Peaks Connection? No.
Except for a lot of weird shit happening, then, like, no, nothing concrete.
Wacky Wardrobe? Third Eye? I mean, that's kind of make up that now. War? No. X-Files Connection? Outer Space.
I mean, other than just, yeah, the Lovecraft stuff.
Oh, wow. Okay, so I thought we were going to be a lot higher than that, but Grand Isle had 35. This has 36.
Okay.
All right.
So it's on par.
You know what I really liked as a final note? I liked when, like, the very end when they were, like, smearing, when they were, like, the kid was, like, trying to walk, and it looked like you took, like, the Photoshop thing and just smeared him. Like, and they were sort of walking around, like, spaghettified and stuff.
Yeah,
I thought
time distortion of that energy vortex.
That's what I'm saying.
It's a nice looking movie.
I really like everything about this except for the fact that, well, like, except for Nicolas Cage.
Well, that's why I wanted to bring up another visual thing toward the end there.
No, I think this would be, like, the effects in this are incredible. And watching in 4K on this big old TV, it's just like, oh, this is great to look at.
Yeah, it's in 4K.
As you know from being, like, IRL friends with me, I have not shut up about this movie since I saw it. But so this, I think, is the best visual adaptation of Lovecraft. Like, they get the weirdness right. I want a Lovecraft movie that uses the exact same technology and concepts as the movie Cats, because I have never seen a more mind-boggling thing. Like, my brain broke during that movie, because I was like, this is a human, this is a cat. No, it's somewhere in between, and then your brain tries to go back and forth, and you lose your sanity.
Mm-hmm.
If they just... I want that CGI to... Like, if you need to ever show a Shoggoth, don't get, like, a big goopy thing like In the Mouth of Madness did. Like, just do that weird CGI that broke everyone's brain who saw that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Please, it's out there. Just take it.
If you could recommend people watch this or Cats...
Well, this is a direct Lovecraft adaptation, and that is just...
It's really, inspired by Lovecraft.
That's inspired by.
Really captures the... If you want to feel what it's like to see something indescribable and unnameable and lose your mind and be a Lovecraft protagonist, then watch Cats. Have a tall glass of water and watch Cats.
Mike almost died in the theater.
I was hurting hard.
And I said to him before the movie starts, I said, no matter how bad it gets, just remember, you will never see a movie that's like this again.
Agreed.
Even before we had seen a single frame. And he's like, okay. And then after the movie, you said to me that, like, you thought, a couple times you almost left, but then you're like, you remembered what I said.
Yep.
Not that it's like sage advice, but I'm like, there's no way that we're about to see should be in 4,000 theaters.
Well, I knew from the first shot when the cat was a cloud.
Yeah.
I was like, this is gonna hurt.
Any other thoughts about Color Out of Space?
See it.
Yeah,
it's fun.
Check it out.
Expect little. It's hollow.
That's, I think, the other issue is that, like, this had been hyped by...
But look, aside from, like, you know, Midsommar and Lighthouse and, you know, there's very little, like, for, in my opinion, stuff to, like, really stack up these days.
This could have been Fantasy Island or Escape Room.
Exactly. This could have sucked. Like, you know, and, like, no, it's not Hereditary, granted, right? Okay. It's not Black Christmas, okay? I'll just throw that. I haven't seen it yet, but from what I heard, I'm just trying to find an example. You know what I'm saying? It's not just another throwaway horror thing. This actually feels like it was crafted, like there's care put into this.
That's what I've said the entire time.
No, I know. I'm not arguing that with you.
And I'll always
not arguing that with
admire
you.
A film that is, like, crafted. It's like...
Love crafted?
Yeah.
Crafted with love.
We were watching some trailers, me and some friends yesterday, and we saw the trailer for the new Nolan movie. My friend was like, are you excited for this? And I'm like, no, I'm really not excited for Nolan movies anymore, but he's one of our last, like, auteurs who has original concepts, original visions, and all of his movies at the very least are interesting. So, like, I'm gonna see it, but no, I'm not excited for it. Anything that is still unique, I think, is important in this world where every movie is just a Marvel movie. Him on TV getting interviewed as, like, the wacky farmer who found the meteorite.
Oh,
I thought that was
so
really
good.
I thought he did a really good job acting as, like, the awkward guy.
And he's like,
TV.
I look like an asshole.
And not in
TV.
Cage mode. Like, he's actually doing a good job acting kind of human in an awkward situation.
I did like that, but that was by the point in the movie where I was not on board with him anymore, and I was just like, I want to like this, and I don't. But I do, in retrospect, removed from the movie, him watching himself be awkward. I didn't say it was UFO. You said it was UFO. Like, I like that, but it's just, at the moment, I was just like...
Was UFO witness bourbon enthusiast in the cryon on the bottom?
For all things Cage Club and now and again, and all 26 shows on the podcast network. Go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, mailbag@cageclub.me. Come back next time. Who knows when?
Oh, yeah, we don't know when. What. We really don't, because I feel like the last six movies
last year, we didn't have a movie until August, and then we had August, September, October, November, December.
January.
This was January.
Technically.
But we, quote unquote, should have done it in February, but it's, you know, basically February. But yeah, I don't know what's coming out this year. Nope. I don't know.
I think Jiu-Jitsu is supposed to come out at some point. I think that movie Pig is supposed to come out at some point, but I don't really,
But what I know what is coming out very soon is that after I edit this episode, the next thing I'm editing is the Viva Pod Vegas episode of King Creole.
King Creole.
So go check that out over on that podcast feed. Check out every Tuesday, Too Fast, Too Forever. Every Friday, Tom Club, Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise, Cruise Club, and Hanks with the Memories. All 26 shows, all sorts of fun things. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
I'm Chris Podcast.
We'll see you next time right here on Cage Club.